I believe I had just mentioned two things in that regard. First, God's existence is assumed. Second, monotheism is presupposed, and in that sense it is taught. And then we had some discussion of the plural form of the word for God, Elohim. But that certainly is not an indication of polytheism, and probably not even of plurality in the deity, but rather majesty, exaltedness. Let's go on to C. God is the omnipotent creator of the universe. That certainly is clearly brought out in Genesis chapter 1. God is the omnipotent creator of the universe. You have through that chapter the repeated expression, and God said, and God said, and God said. And he speaks in connection with a number of creative acts. So God is the omnipotent creator of the universe. Hebrews 11:3 says, the universe was formed at God's command. And certainly that is a reflection of the teaching of Genesis 1 as well. All right, D. God is separate from his creation. God is separate from his creation. There's no hint of pantheism in the Old Testament, where the deity is identified with the created order. The God of Genesis 1-3 and of the Old Testament is not a nature God. He's separate. He's distinct from his creation. And that sets the biblical material apart from a lot of the contemporary mythological material of the ancient Near East. So God is separate from his creation. G. Ernest Wright, in his God Who Acts book, says on page 21, I believe this is on your bibliography. Let's see what page we are there. 3A1. Yeah. It's on page 6, about the fourth entry. G. Ernest Wright, God Who Acts, page 21. On page 21, he says, here then is an utterly different God from the gods of all natural, cultural, and philosophic religion. He's no immanent power in nature, nor in the natural process of being and becoming. The nature of his being and will is revealed in his historical acts. He thus transcends nature as he transcends history, and consequently he destroys the whole basis of pagan religion. No force or power in the world is more characteristic of him than any other, and it's increasingly understood today that the former identifications in early Israel of a mountain god, a fertility god, a war god, from which the ethical monotheism of the prophets gradually evolved, are figments of scholarly presupposition and imagination. It is impossible, on any empirical grounds, to understand how the God of Israel could have evolved out of polytheism. He is unique, sui generis, utterly different. I think that's a pretty good statement about the uniqueness of the deity that is described in the Old Testament, and particularly even here in Genesis 1. I think those four things I've mentioned, his existence being assumed, monotheism presupposed, he's the omnipotent creator of the universe, and he's separate from that creation. Those elements combine to give a unique God concept, a very high God concept, that is very important for the rest of the Old Testament. Let's go on to two, general teaching about the universe. Again, four rather brief comments, but I think things which, taken together, are significant concerning the universe. A, the universe is not self-existent or divine. The universe is not self-existent or divine. In other words, the universe is not an extension of the essence of God. That distinction between God and the created universe. It's not self-existent, and it's not divine. B, it is not inherently evil or antagonistic to God and man. The universe is not inherently evil or antagonistic to God and man. And of course, you find that in that repeated phrase also in Genesis. After the specific creative acts, you read, and God saw that it was good. It was good. It was good. It was good. So the essential character of the created order is good. There are many philosophies and religions that hold that matter is basically evil. And they place that antithesis between matter and spirit. The matter is evil. That's not a concept of the Bible. Of course, the creation becomes affected by the fall, but is not inherently evil. It was created pleasing and good. C, the universe came into being at the will of a divine creator. I've already said it's not self-existent or divine, but it comes into being at the will of a divine creator. God calls it forth, he speaks these creative words, and it comes into being. And D, its formation followed orderly stages. And you find that described for us throughout chapter 1 through the 6 days of creative activity. Its formation followed orderly stages. So I think that's sort of a summarization of general teaching about the universe. We're going to look at more specifics at Genesis 1, but certainly that's some of the general teaching. Thirdly, general teaching about man. And first, the same as with the universe. Man is not self-existent or divine. Man is a creature, been created by God at a particular time in history, and he's separate from God. B, man owes its existence to a creative act of God. Man owes his existence to a creative act of God. Of course, that we'll discuss this later, the relation of evolutionary theory to Genesis 1 and 2. I don't think you can accommodate Genesis 1 and 2 to an evolutionary view of origin. In any way. C, man comes as the culmination of the creative acts of God. Genesis 1 runs toward a climax, and it's on the sixth day, at the end of other creative activities, that God creates man and woman. So, man comes as the culmination of the creative acts of God. D, man is separate from all the rest of God's creation because he was made in the image and likeness of God. Now, at a certain point, man shares characteristics with the rest of the creation as being a creature, part of God's creation, but he's also distinct in that he possesses something that no other creature does, and that is the image of God. And you find that in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. And 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. I think we get a long discussion of what the image of God and man is. What does that constitute? But I don't want to do that at this point. But I think we can say man is a spiritual, rational, moral being. Spiritual, rational, moral being. And that distinguishes man from the animals because he is made in the image of God. E, man has divine authority or dominion over the animal creation and is given the task of subduing the earth. Man has divine authority for dominion over the animal creation and is given the task of subduing the earth. That's in 1:28. God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. and hath dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So I think those teachings together sort of summarize what we find in Genesis 1 concerning mankind. He's not self-existent or divine. He owes his existence to a creative act of God. He comes as the culmination of the creative acts of God. He's separate from the rest of God's creation because of the image. And he has authority for dominion over the animals and to subdue the earth. Okay, let's go on to 4. Interpretations of Genesis 1:1. As already mentioned, Genesis 1:1 is a majestic statement with no parallel in the extra-biblical literature of the time. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, I read from the King James, the NIV is the same except heaven is plural. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if you look at the ancient versions, the ancient translations of the Hebrew of the Old Testament, you get a similar rendering. And what I mean by that is, you find a rendering that makes Genesis 1:1 an independent clause, a sentence with a period. Today, if you look at a lot of commentaries and some translations, you will find that instead of an independent clause, it's a subordinate clause. If you take the RSV, for example, it translates it, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, as the King James does, but it has a footnote. And the footnote reads, when God began to create the heaven and the earth, the earth was out form and void. See, it makes it a subordinate clause to what follows. The New English Bible doesn't have any footnote. It just translates the phrase, in the beginning of creation, when God made heaven and earth, the earth was without form and void. Which again subordinates verse 1 to verse 2. So there's a lot of discussion, particularly if you get into commentaries. Is Genesis 1:1 to be taken as an independent clause, as a statement, or is it to be taken as a subordinate clause, subordinated to what follows? Which is the best translation? I would say grammatically, you can make a case for either. In other words, there's a certain ambiguity grammatically, and you can argue it back and forth. So let's discuss this a bit further under 4. I'll give you a couple subpoints that are not on your outline sheet. A is Genesis 1:1 taken as an independent clause. You take it as an independent clause, which I think is the best way to understand it. That still doesn't answer certain questions, and that is, how do you interpret the significance of the statement as an independent clause? What's its function? And I think there are at least 3 possible interpretations as an independent clause. The first one would be, it's a summary of the entire chapter. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. A summary of the entire chapter. In other words, it'd be much like a newspaper headline or a lead sentence in an essay. Sort of summarizes everything that's to follow. Now, there's a lot to be said for that interpretation. In fact, I just glanced here at the NIV Study Bible, and the note at 1:1 says, a summary statement introducing the 6 days of creative activity. That's the interpretation that the writer of those notes to. The problem with that view is, all these views have certain problems, that's why they're different views. The problem is that verse 2 does not seem like a suitable beginning of the story of creation. If 1 is just the headline, verse 2 doesn't seem like a suitable beginning of the story of creation, but rather it tells the state of unordered created matter. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. It would seem, in other words, a bit strange to begin the creation account itself with the earth was formless and empty. But I'm not saying that to say you cannot take 1:1 as an independent clause. It seems to me, though, if you do take it as an independent clause, it would be best to understand it as creation, and I'll use this term because it'll come up later, ex nihilo.
It's a Latin term that's often used. From nothing.
Creation out of nothing. It's best to understand the term create as creation ex nihilo, creation from nothing. And to understand heaven and earth, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, as a reference to the ordered cosmos, not a reference to unstructured matter that's mentioned in verse 2. And if that's the case, then the creation account really begins in verse 3. And God said, let there be light, and so forth. Verse 2 would give the situation of the world before God began to speak, and then to remove any idea of pre-existent matter, you would say verse 1 is prefaced to speak about the whole thing in the sense of creation ex nihilo. Now, that's sort of moving back from 3:2 to 1, and I think you can make a pretty good case for that. But in that way, then, you would understand verse 1 to be a summary of the entire chapter in a sense of creation ex nihilo and creation from nothing, and the heavens and the earth to refer to the structured, ordered cosmos. Second way that this has been taken is to understand 1:1 to refer to an original creation. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. An original creation that was one of beauty and order, but one which was distinct and far removed in time from verse 2. Now, what that assumes is, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. Here was a beautiful, perfect creation. But then something intervened. There was a cataclysmic change. And in verse 2, you read, the earth, what King James says, was. You translate that, the earth became without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. So that view assumes a cataclysmic change between verse 1 and verse 2. And usually that's connected with the fall of Satan that caused such a change to happen. Who was an angel and rebelled and fell from his original position, affected the universe, brought about this order. So that the conditions of verse 2, in this view, would not be how God originally created things, but they're the results of this cataclysmic change. Now, advocates of this view appeal to the verb in verse 2, which is translated was in the King James. It's translated was in the NIV, although there is a note which says or possibly became. It's very familiar, if any of you are taking Hebrew, some of you are, I'm sure. Very familiar verb. Haya is a verb. To be or to become. Now that verbal form, haya, to be or to become, is used in a number of senses. Sometimes it means to come to pass. Sometimes it means to come into being. And sometimes it just means to be in existence. So, I think what you can see from the word itself, it's sometimes used in a dynamic sense of to become. Sometimes in a static sense of just to be. And it depends on context. You can tell which of those is to be preferred. I don't think you can base an argument on the word for preference of one view over the other. Some have tried to do that. Some have tried to say, Hayah is always this dynamic sort of idea, and it thus must be translated became, and try to use that to support the idea of a cataclysmic change between verse 1 and verse 2. I don't think usage will bear that out. I don't think you can base your argument on the meaning of the verb, because it goes both ways. And I would say in relation to this view that it is grammatically possible. You know, Hayah can be used in the sense of become. But I don't think there's a great deal of evidence for it, this view. And the result of it is that the rest of the chapter really is not a creation account then, in the true sense of the word. It becomes a rehabilitation of the earth as a dwelling place for men and animals after you see the deterioration of an original perfect and beautiful creation had been caused. I think on, let me see, on your outline sheet, yes, under, yeah, quite just a second, under 3A4 on your bibliography sheet, right in the middle of the page, you see an entry by Fields, W.W. Fields, Unformed and Unfilled. That is a volume, a book-length discussion of Genesis 1:1 and 2. Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. And Fields argues very strongly against this cataclysmic theory of a gap between 1:1 and 1:2. So if you're interested in reading a fuller discussion of what I've spoken of here in a couple of minutes, you can look at Fields' book. You had a question.
If you use the word, is that what people normally refer to as a gap theory?
Gap, it's often called that. Yeah. Now, let me just make a comment there. You see the gap theory. You get into the question that we touched on in a previous hour. We were discussing these genealogies. Where do you put geologic time? There are really only three places you can put it. I'll work backwards. You can put it in the flood. We talked about that, flood geology. All the strata of the earth, so-called geologic time, as explained by the flood. So then you'd be putting it in Genesis 6 to 9. You can put it in the days of Genesis 1, if you understand day to be a period of time, rather than a 24-hour solar day. That's another alternative. We'll discuss that later when we get to it. Or you can put it between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. There are the three places which you can do it. And there are a lot of people that, in order to solve the problem of geologic time, prefer this view, because then they can put that material between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. There have been various other passages in the Old Testament that have been cited as supporting this, connected with the fall of Satan. I think the problem with, and we could spend a lot of time discussing each of these passages, the problem is each of these passages that are alluded to, there's some in Isaiah, there's some in Ezekiel, there's some in Jeremiah, have interpretive problems of their own. And with most of them, there's a very real question if they're even talking about Satan, or whether they're talking about the king of Tyre, or the king of the king of Babylon in Isaiah. And number two, there's no real link established, but even if those passages are talking about Satan, there's no real link established with Genesis 1:2. So you make a number of inferences in order to connect those passages into this, in order to establish this position, so that I don't think it has the firmest evidence. Let's go on to number three. Third possibility is that the statement refers to the creation of matter. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Heaven and the earth there, the building blocks of the universe, you might say, matter. in its raw stages. G.C.H. Alders takes this view. I thought I had put this on your sheet, but I see it's not.
Alders was a Dutch Old Testament scholar, wrote numerous commentaries and other things. He wrote a two-volume commentary on Genesis that recently was translated into English and published by Zondervan in the Bible Students Commentary series. I don't know if you've seen that. It's been coming out for the last 4 or 5 years, sort of volume by volume, which is translation of a whole set of Old Testament commentaries. It was published in Dutch. Alders didn't write all the commentaries, but he did do the Genesis one. And in volume one of that, Commentary on Genesis by Alders, page 52, he says, since verse 1 is not just a heading, he rejects the first verse, it is likewise true beyond doubt that the heavens and the earth do not here refer to the present organized universe as it appeared after the creative work described in Genesis 1 was completed. How the universe became what it is today is described in detail in verses 3 to 31. The heavens and the earth in verse 1 are thus a designation of the essence of the world before the detailed forming and ordering, which is described in the rest of the chapter, took place. We can conclude then that the term heavens and earth in verse 1 refers to the substance of the universe. We can also say it this way, that Genesis 1:1 describes the creation of the substance from which the entire universe was formed. Now you see, with that view, it flows quite naturally into verse 2. If you understand heaven and the earth to be sort of a figurative designation for the substance, the building block, the elements of the universe, you see that it flows into verse 2 when the earth was without form and void. It was unstructured, unordered. And then it begins to be structured as God moves further. So that is also a possibility. The problem with it is that you have to take heaven and earth then in a somewhat figurative sense. And you wonder, should that be done? But it does give continuity with verse 2. So I think it merits serious consideration. To me, either the first view, the heading view, or this third view has the most to be said for it. Question.
Does it say it's taking heavens and earth figuratively because in verse 2 it says the earth was about one?
Yeah. Possibly. Of course, it doesn't say, there it doesn't say heaven and earth. You just get one of the two elements. But what does that earth in verse 2 represent? It seems to, you're right, represent some kind of unstructured situation that existed before God began to order things for us. All right, B. See, A under 4 was taking Genesis 1:1 as an independent clause. I gave you three interpretations of the phrase as an independent clause. B is to take 1:1 as a subordinate clause. Now, as a subordinate clause, there are basically two views. One would make the verse subordinate to verse 2, and the other would make it subordinate to verse 3, with verse 2 sort of as a parenthesis. So first, the view that verse 1 is subordinate to verse 2. Now, the whole reason for this discussion centers around the first word in the Hebrew text, which is Bereshit, in the beginning. Those of you who haven't had Hebrew, or even if you have, I'm not going to really dwell on the Hebrew here, but just to say that the question is whether that first word is to be understood as being in the absolute or the construct case. Absolute or construct. And there grammarians argue about that. I don't want to go ahead and get into the technical part of that. But I think there are two considerations that strongly favor understanding it as an absolute. And if you understand it as an absolute, you will take it as an independent clause in the beginning of God's creation. If you take it as a construct, you're going to take it as a subordinate clause. Now, those of you who have had some Hebrew know something about absolute construct. If you haven't had Hebrew, take it down. When you do have it, it'll make some sense to you. If you don't ever take it, you can just pay attention to what follows from this discussion. There are two things that strongly favor the absolute. Two things that strongly favor. First, that the Masoretic text accents. Accent the word with a disjunctive accent. And that is a strong indication that the Masoretes understood it as absolute. Of course, the Masoretes were. Accent it with a disjunctive accent that indicates they understood it as an absolute. Secondly, with no exception, the ancient versions take it as an absolute when they translate. In other words, Septuagint, Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Syriac, all the ancient versions understand it without exception as an absolute. Doesn't mean that it couldn't be a construct. There's an ambiguity there. Could be. But it seems that the weight of evidence favors the absolute. Now, those that take it as the construct and translate it something like, when God began to create the heavens and the earth, most of them would subordinate it to verse 2. When God began to create the heavens and the earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. Some, however, would say, you see my time's up, that verse 2 is a parenthesis. And verse 1 would read, when God began to create the heaven and the earth, parenthesis, the earth was without form and void, darkness upon the face of the deep. Then God said. So you see, when God began to create, then God said. Verse 3 is continuation of the statement, with verse 2 is a parenthesis. That makes a rather awkward syntactical thing and complicated thing, which I think argues against it. As far as meaning, I'm going to have to hold that. We'll pick that up beginning of the next chapter.